welcome to Open Source Democracy. This time it's about search and what some are calling the future of search, chatbots. For more than two decades, Google Search has shaped how we navigate the web. But things are changing. The uptake of generative AI is transforming search from a tool that points to information into a system that offers synthesized answers. We are taking a dive into the infrastructures of search and AI and the different responses they generate. I am Pernille Tranberg, a journalist specialized in data and AI ethics. As AI reshapes the landscape of information, it becomes even more urgent to understand what happens behind the interface. For this, I welcome two people in the studio. Anders Visti is an artist working with code. He is the initiator of two public forums for artists, researchers and hackers using tech for creative expression. And Renee Ridgway, who is part of this open source democracy project. She has a background as an artist, did a PhD on search and is presently a researcher at the Department of Digital Design and Information Studies at Aarhus University. Anders and Renee are running a research site and a chatbot, Rodeo. Anders, what is that?
It's basically two different things. So, and it's all has to do with Renee's PhD research, which is about search algorithms, search engines. One part of this backend that we did, like a platform, tools for thinking about search. So one part of this is a tool that visualizes differences between search engines. So, and it's really a tool that you use on your own computer. So you can make the same search in two different engines, two different search environments, and you can compare the SERPs, as they are called, the search engine result pages, and see, get a sense of exactly how different these results can be. Because I think people tend to think of the results they get from search engines as fairly neutral in a way. But actually, when you look into it, these SERPs are quite different. So it matters what type of search engine you use and what type of browser you use. And this tool helps you to visualize that. That's like the first part of this tool. The second part of the tool is the chatbot Rodeo, as you mentioned. And that's a tool where you get to see and check out for yourself how different that chatbots really respond to your prompt. So it's a new kind of interface in a way. It's like a multi-LLM council or debate tool where you are having up to five different chatbots talking to each other and responding to your prompt, but also seeing actually the responses that all the other chatbots are making and then sort of discussing actually what is the best answer to your prompt. So it's both tools that kind of visualize and help you as a user get a sense of proportion about what these digital cultures really are, you know?
Renee, the vast majority has been using Google Search for decades, not really understanding the infrastructure based on surveillance. Why do you think this is?
To begin, behind the scenes, there is a hidden auction where third-party actors are bidding on keywords that in turn determine the search results, so higher ranking. And then there's targeted ads that direct users' attention. At the same time, all this personal data is collected ad infinitum by big tech. To use Google as an example, this is what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, and the extent to how it has now changed our lives the past decades. And what happens to that data? Well, there's a data afterlife. It travels, it's used by many third parties, and then that so-called behavioral surplus is reflected back to us, changing what we see online and view as information. And this affects our decisions, which in turn affects how we think as citizens, and this affects democracy. And all of this is contingent on convenience. Many people think that Facebook or even Google is the internet, and not realizing how the World Wide Web is structured through hyperlinking, where the larger sites receive more attention.
A minority today might be interested in knowing more about how search works, but why should more users be interested in the underlying infrastructure when it comes to Google and now AI search?
Many people haven't tried to search outside of their default settings, so it's actually a question about search literacy. And when the infrastructures of Google Search, or at least what we can tell based on our results, because all of this is proprietary knowledge, is explained to them through direct comparison with other results from other search engines and browsers, there's often this aha moment. And the method that we've been developing called data visualization as transcription is a method for converting search results, making what is not visible or representable legible. And by giving form to data, by saving queries and parsing the results into comparative visualizations, you can see different results obtained from search engines and from browsers side by side. So it reflects these similarities and differences. And for example, when one hovers over the hyperlink, the aesthetic emphasis is placed on the contents, so the lighter blue lines reflect weaker links. And matching and ranking through differentiated colors show Google's own agenda of hierarchizing its own products and services, while alternatives provide diversity in the search results. And this will be taken up in a forthcoming article to be published in the special issue, STS by Aesthetic Means, in STS Encounters, which is published by the Danish Association for Science and Technology Studies.
You are trying to increase awareness with your research site. Which search engines are covered?
Right now, the upload backend allows users to choose a range of search engines. There's Baidu, which has a Chinese interface. There's Bing, which is US, Microsoft. DuckDuckGo, which is also US, but privacy first. Google, Yahoo, and Yandex, which is Russian and has an English interface. There are also diverse browsers. Brave is an open source browser in the US based on Chromium, but it also incorporates its own advertising through a reward system based on cryptocurrency, which allows users to earn basic attention tokens by opting to view ads. Chrome, which is Google, collects the most data of any browser. Then there's Edge, which is from Microsoft. Then there's Firefox, which is open source and run by the Mozilla Foundation. And Opera, which is based on Chromium, but it's incorporated in the Cayman Islands and is a subsidiary of Kunlun Tech Company, which is based in Beijing and listed on the Shenzhen Stock Exchange. And lastly, Safari, which is Apple.
You don't have Vivaldi, the Norwegian browser.
No.
Invented by the same guys who sold Opera to the Chinese.
We are actually trying to develop having Ecosia and Quant. And those are two European search engines and index to have on the website.
Cool. What browser and search engine do you use yourself for the best results?
My default is DuckDuckGo and Firefox. Though when I use Safari, I often change my default search engines to see which results I get. And of course I use Google and Brave and Yahoo and all of them actually to test them out and see how they differ.
Anas, what browser and search engines do you use yourself for the best results?
Right now I'm using Brave with the DuckDuckGo as my search engine, default search engine. Because I work with software development, I have to have all browsers and all kinds of tools installed on my machine, so I shift a lot. But right now, I'm very content with the Brave browser and the DuckDuckGo. I can find what I'm searching for, typically, now. Yeah.
Your tool, the research.site, makes obvious that the choice of browser and search engine really shapes what you see. Could you discuss some of the results, some examples of the differences you get out of your tool?
So one obvious difference is, of course, that some engines try to hide you as a user. The DuckDuckGo engine is, of course, based on trying to anonymize your search. And that means that you get less commodified results, of course. Like if you compare to using Google as a search engine, it provides you with so much more information that's not stuff you have to buy, right? So it's, of course, less commodified. Obviously, because the financial model of Google is really to sell you stuff, right? So that's a big and obvious difference, I would say.
Renee, do you have concrete examples of the differences?
Yes. So with the keywords data afterlife, the top results were Chicago University's bookstore, and the next six links were all articles pertaining to the same topic with DuckDuckGo. And whereas the Google search results reflected a much more commercial approach out of its top five results. There was another participant who searched with generative music in MIDI, and he was surprised at how DuckDuckGo gave him very, very relevant results with the Firefox browser compared to his default, which was Google and Chrome. There was another AI and art were the keywords, where DuckDuckGo and Chrome provided alternative and more academic results than the commercial results with Chrome and Google. And with World Peace, Google really tried to push other things forward, like Instagram at the top, whereas Firefox was focusing more on world peace and more diversity. And then a real concrete example is also post-digital. So when you search post-digital on Google, because it collects locative data, it shows Borger.dk. It shows postal services. Whereas when you search with post-digital on Firefox and DuckDuckGo, it gives you more of a media art terminology, different references for books and things like that.
Anas, even the URL reveals how much data is stored about you. Can you explain what kind of data you can find out of the URL?
Yeah, there's a lot of difference there, actually. Also, previously we compared DuckDuckGo and Google, right? And those are very different when it comes to URL parameters, as they're called. So when you send your search request to your search engine, there's a lot of data that comes with that request, and you can see that in the address field of your browser, actually. So it stores a lot of information after the server that you're sending it to, the search engine, right? So, and DuckDuckGo, who tries to anonymize your search, does not require a lot of URL parameters. It's basically very vague what you're doing, right? Seems obvious, but Google will put in all kinds of parameters in your search request. It has to do with the location data. It also has some user agent sniffing, as it's called. It kind of knows what type of browser you're using, what device you are sending this request from. So, and basically it fits very well with this. Google is trying to track you so they can receive as much data about your request and your browser use as possible. Right?
With AI chatbots, we are witnessing a shift in how we search. Instead of providing a list of hyperlinks, we are also provided with a single authoritative answer. Renee, what is the difference between getting chatbots overview rather than ranked hyperlinks?
There are a few differences in the search results nowadays due to this introduction of these big tech companies that supply generative answers, which are statistically produced predictions based on training data with millions of iterations. And these answers usually appear at the top of the page as a summary, called overviews or AI overviews. And sometimes people want a direct answer because they're asking something very specific, so it's an easy Q and A. But other times it's about finding information and deciding which path to choose, which is why links are helpful. And also, most importantly, the links provide the source, which is called the provenance of information. And this increases verifiability and helps to prevent disinformation, or as they're called, hallucinations.
Yeah, because the summary can be hallucinations, right?
Correct.
Anas, your chatbot rodeo. That's a very cool title, by the way. What is that?
It's a tool where you can check out how different chatbots talk to each other or answer your prompt, right? And you can see in the user interface, you can see these different chatbots' responses to your prompt at the same time. And some of the inspiration for that was something called an LM Arena, where you can see, you can choose which kind of model chatbot you want to talk to, and you can vibe check, so to speak, which type of bot you'd like to interact with, right? So this is an iteration beyond that, because we are now making these chatbots actually talk to each other and be aware of what the answers are. So you have something that you can think about as a multi-LLM council or a debate arena in a way. And hence the name Rodeo was invented by Rene, right? So now you can sort of negotiate what an answer is between the bots also, and makes it really interesting to talk to these bots. So that's what it's really about, yeah.
Can you explain some of the different results you're seeing? How different are they?
Right, so one obvious difference is that they are trained, the foundational models of these chatbots are trained in different times, yeah? So I was talking to the chatbot Rodeo yesterday, and I was asking it whether or not Venezuela had been invaded. And surprisingly, you know, 4 out of 5 bots said that, no, that didn't happen. But that's because their foundational models were trained in maybe a year ago. So they don't know anything about recent events. And then one chatbot, Perplexity, that also uses web search as part of its response, was more updated and said, yes, actually, there was an attempt of an invasion recently. And then it's interesting to sort of see, if you then talk to them, about how could you negotiate which answer is the most correct one? So that's very interesting, but because now they're sort of vibe-checking each other, fact-checking each other in a way.
René, what are your observations when it comes to the differences between the chatbots?
So far, we have different chatbots. So we have Gemini, we have ChatGPT, we've had Llama, we have LitChat from Mistral, which seems to answer questions more ethically and brings up the words ethically when we ask it about what data the chatbots have been trained on, for example. We also have Perplexity now, and Perplexity provides, also because it's dealing with live web search, it provides hyperlinks, or at least the citations of them. But of course, Perplexity is being now sued by different companies for copyright infringement, the BBC, the Dow Jones, New York Times, and even Reddit. So there's this type of understanding that Perplexity builds its own index, but it doesn't recognize robots.txt, which means that it's still scraping and crawling illegally. And that's been shown by 2 articles by Wired and Cloudflare.
Please explain how the chatbots could change our understanding of open source.
Many use the term open source, but actually they're open weight models because, you know, open source sounds progressive and opened. And so they don't disclose the parameters on which the model was trained. But Opertus, unlike other prior models, releases weights, but it also has a regard for owner content rights. Opertus, which is an academic model from Switzerland, are pre-trained exclusively on openly available data, so public data. And it respects robots.txt exclusions and filtering for non-permissive, toxic, and personal identifiable content. So the other thing about Opertus is, in the sense that it's European, it has all these different languages. I think it's now around 1,800 languages that it's been trained on. So beyond model weights, they release all scientific artifacts in the development cycle with a permissive license, including data preparation scripts, checkpoints, evaluation suites, and the training code, enabling transparent audit and extension.
Anas, why is open source the method you prefer?
It's important to me because I think there is a notion of the user that is more open. Open source is typically has an ethics that allows users to have control over their software, right? And it can give people insight into what these machines are actually doing, right? So from the beginning, all of my hours in front of the screen really has been moving towards actually having control over the software I use and how I use my machine. And it's kind of an original sense of user perspective, like the personal computer from the early days. That's really what I like, you know. And I've been seeing the commodified software trying to take some of that control back. And I really do worry now that AI is an attack on what we call the general purpose computer. So everyone now has a really powerful machine just below the friction-free UIs that everyone is using now. There's really a very powerful machine that you can control in the way you want to. And to me, that's like an open source perspective on the user, right? You have access, you are free to make the software you want, to use it how you want, and you can actually manifest your own voice and express yourself with this machine if you want to, right? So, and I worry that AI is maybe attacking this idea by making the user interface so slick that no one has access anywhere, really. And that's why I prefer and think that open source is really the way forward. Yeah.
And related to that, why is open source good for democracy?
Well, of course, obviously the same thing, right? Because it enables everyone to have insight and to have a sense of proportion and to make informed decisions about how they use the data, their personal data. And we are seeing the problem with commodified software now, that it takes away insight and control. And that is not good for democracy, of course.
Thank you so much, Anders Visti. René, Europe's alternative to Google's index, what is that?
It's an EU-funded project. It's the Open Web Index, which is the Open Search Foundation and the University of Passau received 8 million euros to build this Open Web Index. It's federated with 14 partners. And so far, they have crawled 9.15 billion URLs in 185 languages, which is around 1 terabyte crawling per day. And there are more than 1,000 public data sets. So this now allows a panoply of researchers, search applications, they have their own Mosaic browser under development, they can make use of this non-proprietary index with permission. And commercial search engines are going to use it as well.
What is the biggest enemy for a service like the Open Web Index?
Well, not enough investment. And they need more financial support from the EU. They need also to have this raising awareness of alternatives. And that's really important in these different types of projects, that you just don't get seed funding, that you're able to continue the development, because they have 14 partners now, including CERN, for example.
And what can you get there that you cannot get from Google?
Well, the Open Web Index doesn't collect user data. And it's not based on surveillance capitalism, as we discussed at the beginning of this podcast. And it has ethical search results, because the development and the applications that use the index are designed that way. And there's a risk assessment that people fill in before they actually use the index. There's the possibility of vertical search and finding special collections of information, but also having reliability. And the Open Web Index promotes Europe's digital sovereignty because it's an independent web index. Unlike Google's proprietary index, which we have been contributing to and building for the last 25 years. And so, for example, since December 2025, there's this huge human-edited web directory called curly.org, which is now made available on the openwebsearch.eu initiative. And this is something that all different people can use, the curly.org, which is actually what Google has been using in its secret sauce for all of these years. So, to sum up, the openwebsearch.eu is offering this pilot version of the Open Web Index, and anyone can use it. It's an expandable search infrastructure that complies with European democratic values, legal regulations, and standards. And it enables the creation of alternative search engines that do not have to rely on an index from big tech companies. And if you want to use it, please get in touch. The link will be in the show notes.
This was the last podcast in our open source democracy project. Find links in the show notes. Thank you so much, Anders Visti. Thanks to René Ridgway for inspiring and fruitful collaboration. Thanks to Carlsberg Minilegate for financial support. The music is made by Joytown.